Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. She was bigger, faster, and stronger than the Titanic. The SS United States was a symbol of American ingenuity in the years following World War II. She carried more than a million passengers across the Atlantic in grand style and was even featured in a few movies. The architect of the massive ocean liner was William Francis Gibbs, a Philadelphian who mostly taught himself how to build ships and dreamed of creating one that would surpass the rest. Gibbs and the relentless pursuit of his dream are the subject of a new book by Stephen Ujifusa called A Man and His Ship, America's Greatest Naval Architect and His Quest to Build the SS United States. Stephen is a historian who is a contributor to PlanPhilly.com. He also serves on the advisory council of the SS United States Conservancy. It's a national nonprofit dedicated to saving the ship and preserving her historical legacy. Stephen earned his master's degree in historic preservation and real estate from the University of Pennsylvania and his bachelor's in history from Harvard University. Stephen, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, describe this grand ship, the SS United States, in her heyday.
Well, the SS United States was the finest, fastest ocean liner ever built. She was completed in 1952, and in her day, she was described as a floating Waldorf Astoria. Imagine the Chrysler Building turned on its side, luxuriously outfitted and able to go through the Atlantic at 40 miles an hour. And she could go 38.32 knots, which is about 44 miles per hour. And in her day, she was the ship that carried celebrities, Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy. I'm not sure if they traveled at the same time.
And that's a whole other show, right?
And ex-presidents Truman and Eisenhower, John Wayne. It was an era when transatlantic liners were the only way to cross. It was before the jet, which came in the late 50s. So basically, movie stars going to Europe for film shoots. You had businessmen traveling to European capitals. You had soldiers being stationed abroad. It was truly a cross-section of America at the time. And the effort that it takes to build a transatlantic liner is truly stupendous. And it was the vision of one man, a Philadelphian, William Francis Gibbs, who absolutely loved this ship. In many ways, he was comparable to John Augustus Roebling of the Brooklyn Bridge, mm-hmm. or Frank Lloyd Wright.
So they would have been contemporaries almost, or at least they would have been of the same ilk of Gibbs. Tell us a little bit more about him. He's quite a fascinating character.
William Francis Gibbs was born in Philadelphia in 1886, and his father was an extremely wealthy financier who was a business partner of Peter Widener's. So William Francis Gibbs grew up in a mansion on North Broad Street, and then when he was a teenager, the family moved to Rittenhouse Square to a very grand address on the northeast corner. And William Francis Gibbs basically knew from the age of 8 what he wanted to do. His father took him to see an ocean liner called the St. Louis, launched at Cramp Shipyard on the Delaware River. And when he saw that ship roar down the ways and splash into the Delaware in 1894, he said he knew what he wanted to do with his life. But his father was not so hot on the idea of him being a naval architect. So Gibbs was a very reclusive, shy child, very awkward. He was only good at one sport, tennis, and he ended up going to Harvard and had a miserable time with his engineering classes. He had to drop out, actually, his senior year because his father lost his fortune. It was a very embarrassing situation. Mm-hmm. Gibbs had to drop out and work his way through the rest of his BA, where he finished at Columbia, and started working as a lawyer and hated it, absolutely hated being a lawyer. He knew what he wanted to do, so after a year, he began coming up with designs for his own ship. This is around 1912, 1913, around the time of the Titanic. And eventually, he apprenticed himself to a very famous admiral who saw this kid might have been struggling a bit with math, but really had guts and talent. And Admiral Taylor, who was chief constructor of the U.S. Navy, took him on. And that's where Gibbs learned how to be a naval architect.
It's really remarkable, isn't it, Stephen, that he could get access to these materials and be able to teach himself to such a large degree. While he's studying other subjects in college, he's in engineering, eventually he goes to law school, but all the while he's accessing these materials and teaching himself. I mean, we live in the age of Google, but it's just remarkable to me that he was able to do that.
Yeah, Gibbs had access. His father, because his father was an entrepreneur himself, had engineering publications throughout his studies. So Gibbs spent, you know, kind of like a kid in his parents' garage, looking through all this stuff and building models. So he started out very young, but he learned a lot from Admiral Taylor. And eventually, by the 1920s, he's able to open up his own design shop in the 1920s and designed a number of smaller passenger liners, freighters, or whatnot. But he really hit his big break in the 1930s when he is basically given the contract to design a new group of destroyers for Franklin Roosevelt's new Navy. And his destroyers, his Navy ships, are so advanced. They use so much revolutionary engine design, hull design, that puts him on the map.
And that relationship with the Navy would really prove critical for him in terms of then building, being able to build the SS United States.
Exactly. When the SS United States was put on the drawing board soon after World War II, Gibbs basically used a lot of technologies used during World War II, high-pressure, high-temperature steam turbine engines, aluminum structure, into the SS United States, things that had not been used before on passenger ships. And I like to compare William Francis Gibbs in many ways to Steve Jobs. William Francis Gibbs knew engineering principles. He was good at them. But his real strength was as a project leader. He says, I want the ship to look this way. I want it to have these performance specifications. And then he would give it to some very talented subordinates. And then he would follow through and make sure, watch them like a hawk.
He was the big picture guy,
exactly,
so to speak. Yeah. So certainly the journey from him opening this shop as a naval architect to actually completing the SS United States was quite a journey, and there had to be some challenges along the way as well.
Yes, it was. It was a 40-year journey. The biggest one was money, because he really wanted to design a true American transatlantic liner. And an America had not had a real transatlantic liner, American built, since the 1890s with the St. Louis, which is the ship that he saw launched in Philadelphia. And the European governments, Britain, France, Germany especially, but also Italy, they heavily subsidized their transatlantic liners because they saw these ships as national trophies, national symbols of honor and technology. And the United States government was not that interested in the shipping business, and basically took World War II and for the government to see the strategic use of ocean liners as troop transports.
So then, and that was part of it, wasn't it, that in terms of the Navy then helping to support this project, part of it was that this ocean liner, if need be, can be used to transport troops.
Yeah, she was designed pretty much as a troop transport first, and an ocean liner second. The U.S. military saw how the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, which were Britain's great superliners, how they were transformed from being 2,000 passenger liners into 14 or 15,000 person troop ships. I mean, these two ships were the ships that helped bring American troops to Europe for D-Day. And we didn't have anything like that. So at the end of the war, basically, the U.S. government said, well, we'd love to have a ship just like this. And William Francis Gibbs says, I'm the man to give you this.
So it sounds like the two world wars were curse and blessing for him, in the sense that, one, the wars maybe delayed his progress in terms of constructing the ship, but ultimately then helped him to finish and bring his dream to fruition.
Exactly. And as I said, the government provided two-thirds of the ship's $78 million funding, and the United States Lines, which was a private company, it was kind of the equivalent of the Pennsylvania Railroad of U.S. shipping lines. It was a very substantial company. Vincent Astor, who was the son of a famous Titanic victim and multimillionaire, was on the board. But the company didn't have the capital needed to build the ship. So Gibbs and his brother Frederick, who we worked very closely with, helped negotiate with the government to provide that subsidy, both a construction subsidy, two-thirds of the $78 million, and then a very generous operating subsidy.
Wow. So, Stephen, how did this particular ship reflect the spirit of the time in America?
Well, she was basically a symbol of American optimism at the time. It was an era that where America had just beaten the Axis powers. And it was an era when America could say, let's build the finest, fastest ocean liner in the world. We can do it. We are the nation that built the Liberty ship. We're the nation that built tanks that defeated the Axis. Why can't we have a ship like the British or the French? And it was an era when, you know, Europe was seen as being kind of on the wane. Europe had kind of imploded itself during World War II. And the ship was basically all American in terms of her construction. All 48 states contributed furniture, artwork, really? Machinery, boilers, engines. It was an era when America didn't have to really outsource to build an entire ocean liner. The steel from the hull was from the Lukens Steel Company in Coatesville, Pennsylvania. The plastics were from DuPont. And the United States Lines was very proud to note that the ship was entirely American-made. And she was also, her interiors were very, very modern, very sleek. Previous ocean liners looked like English manor houses inside. And William Francis Gibbs and his decorating team didn't like that. William Francis Gibbs was also very scared of fire. So there was almost no wood used in the interior. So it was a very sleek, modern, sort of man-bed look to the inside of the ship.
And this was a time, Stephen, when made in America really meant something.
Very much so. And that was very much a point of pride.
Yeah.
And the British were rather skeptical of this new ship. The Queen Mary, which was built in 1936, had held the record since 1938 after having a duel with the Normandy, a French ship. And the British were kind of skeptical of this new ship. They dismissed it as an all-American job that was practically all metal. And there was a famous cartoon that was published in a London newspaper showing the Queen Elizabeth and the Queen Mary wearing, you know, garden party hats. And they're both steaming next to each other. And the Queen Elizabeth says to the Queen Mary, don't look, my dear, but I believe we're being followed.
And
the SS United States, which is smoking a cigar and having music coming out of it, is barreling towards them.
Those Americans, here they go again. We are having such an interesting discussion. We are talking about a new book, actually, just released. It's called A Man and His Ship, America's Greatest Naval Architect and His Quest to Build the SS United States. The author is Stephen Ujifusa. Stephen is an historian. In fact, he received his bachelor's in history from Harvard University. We're talking about the construction of that ship. We are talking about the naval architect from Philadelphia who designed that ship and how he, for the most part, taught himself how to build ships, and what that ship meant to our nation, to our region, and to our nation, and what was going on in our country around that time. It's a fascinating story. If you've got questions for Stephen about the history of the SS United States or the vision for its future, for that matter, we'd love to hear from you at 888-477-9499. This is Radio Times, and we'll be right back.
Are you frustrated with your child between the ages of 12 and 25 who is using drugs or drinking? Have you argued or pleaded with them to stop? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and improve your relationship with your child. The Family Training Program is held in Philadelphia and surrounding areas by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org.
He was an outsider. He challenged the art world by collecting the new masters and giving them a home. More Cézanne than the Louvre, and the world's largest collection of Renoir. Dr. Albert Barnes and his grand experiment in education, the Barnes Collection, the WHYY original production, proud to be part of the PBS Arts Summer Festival. The Barnes Collection, August 3rd at 9, on WHYY TV. See a preview at whyy.org/barnes.
African Americans have a less than 17% chance of finding a bone marrow match. So when Shayun Adebiyi was diagnosed with blood cancer, the odds were not in his favor.
I thought that even if I couldn't find a match, I wanted to at least make it easier for other black patients to find a match.
Now he's saving lives here and overseas. We'll hear his inspiring story next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are having a wonderful discussion about an ocean liner that actually is right here in the Philadelphia area. Chances are, if you live or work in the Philadelphia area, you have driven past it. You may not have even realized that it was there, but it's the SS United States. It is in quite a state of disrepair, but there are people who are joining forces to try to revive and restore and refurbish this once grand ocean liner. That was stronger and faster than the Titanic. It was designed by a gentleman from Philadelphia who, to a large degree, taught himself how to build ships, and he is a story in himself. The author of the book is Stephen Ujifusa. He is an historian. He is someone who has had a longtime interest in ships, and he's also been involved with the preservation efforts for the SS United States. I want to give our number one more time for those of you who would like to call in with questions for Stephen about the history of this grand ship and what was taking place in the United States at that time, or questions perhaps about what's going to happen for that ship in the future. If you'd like to do that, the number is 888-477-9499. Stephen, tell us what it was like being on board such a grand ocean liner and making a transatlantic crossing on the SS United States.
Well, most people, the peak season for travel would be around now, the summer season, when people would go on vacation or people would go on business trips. And it was a very formal experience compared to today's cruising. In first class, you did dress for dinner, black tie, gowns. It was just unthinkable to show up in the first class dining room, and the menus were incredible. 10-course meals, caviar, filet mignons, and some of the most interesting experiences I've had writing the book have been getting to know the crew members who served as on board the ship. Out of the 1,000 crew members on board, there were 800 plus who were devoted to service. This included stewards, bellboys, barbers, pool attendants, you name it. And she was described by her last captain, Commodore Alexanderson, as one of the last of the floating Waldorf Astorias. Wow. And during the summer season, during the 50s and early 1960s, you were most likely to run into celebrities on board, as I said, the Kennedys, Judy Garland, Marilyn Monroe. And some of the celebrities I've heard stories about from crew members, some of them were very nice. They were very Marlon Brando, for example, wanted to escape these crowds of autograph seekers in the first class dining room, and he decided to give a concert for the crew, just playing the guitar in the crew space. Salvador Dali was a frequent passenger, and Bill Krudner, who was a assistant bell captain and later bell captain on the SS United States, said that Salvador Dali gave him a sketch and thanks for his service, such, providing such fine service. It was of the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty shaking hands. Mm. Bill said he put it on his desk. He left his cabin for a minute. He came back. It was gone. These are the sorts of people you'd run into.
It's fascinating. And there are a number of people still living who worked on that ship or sailed on that ship, your grandparents among them. And tell us about some of the people that you've spoken with who actually were on the ship and some of the memories that they have of it.
Well, I'm trying to think. My grandparents traveled on the ship in the mid to late 50s. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was the one who first told me about the ship when I was a very young child. And it was actually in 1996 when we were looking at colleges in the Philadelphia area. We drove over the Walt Whitman Bridge, and my grandmother was in the car with us. And that was right after the ship had arrived. And she pointed at the ship, and she said, "Oh, I remember that ship. Grandpa and I were on that." And she said it was a very elegant experience. The crew members that I've spoken to, Bill Krudner and Joe Rota, they worked for many years in the ship, and they really enjoyed it. They said it was long hours, and they rubbed elbows with celebrities. It was quite an experience with that. And I'm trying to think who else. Laura Franklin Dunn, she was on the maiden voyage in July 1952. She was the daughter of the President of the United States Lines, and she said it was such a party. Everyone was just boiling over the expectations during this 3.5-day trip. And she said she and Margaret Truman, the daughter of the president, were doing a conga line from the ballroom that night up to the bridge, broke into the bridge, and the Commodore, Commodore Harry Manning and William Francis Gibbs gave them a look of death, and they realized who they were. And then the Commodore said, "Can you, Miss Truman, would you like to put your hand on the wheel?" It was around 3 o'clock in the morning. The ship was barreling along at 36 plus knots, and she did for very briefly.
Wow, what a great story. And oh, to have had a video camera in those days to be able to see some of the people and the goings on and just the elegance of that ship. Absolutely amazing. I want to go to the phones for a moment. We'll start off in Chicago and welcome Donald to Radio Times. Hi, Donald.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
No, I just wanted to say that if you talk about the United States, you really have to mention Gibbs's rebuilding of the Falklands at the end of the First World War. You have to mention the America, which was more or less a progenitor of the United States. And also the fact that when the Normandy was taken over by the U.S. Navy, Gibbs was all over the ship seeing what Vladimir Yurkovich had done in his design. So, I mean, Gibbs didn't just come to the United States from nowhere. He designed some of the most important ships of the U.S. Navy, World War II, his firm designed. And he's a fascinating man. And the whole company's fascinating. The brother, the partner, Daniel Cox, they were all interesting people. And that's all I wanted to say. I traveled on the United States when I was a little kid, so don't ask me about it. But I did travel on the America also when she was almost just before she retired, when they were running cruises out of New York about 30 years ago, just before they took her out of service after she had already left the United States lines and was in Chandler's. And it was fascinating. It was like going back in time because the ship basically had changed very little from the Art Deco interiors of the late 30s. And that's all I wanted to say. It's a fascinating program. I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad somebody's doing something about the United States. I'm a New Yorker. I used to go down to Philadelphia. My brother lives outside of Philly to see the ship sitting there all rusting away.
Well, Donald, thanks for your call. You're very, very knowledgeable, and we appreciate it. Stephen?
It's a very good point, Donald. And yes, Gibbs, during those 40 years of trying to build the SS United States, worked on many other ships. And interesting, he brought up the Vaterland. The Vaterland was a German ship built in 1914 that was the largest ship in the world. And she was seized by the U.S. Government in 1917 when America entered the war. She was stuck in a U.S. port. And she was used as a troop ship and pretty much trashed and renamed the Leviathan. And Gibbs was given the task of rebuilding this enormous liner. She was actually bigger than the United States. Into the flagship of the U.S. passenger fleet. And Gibbs learned so much looking over this German ship. She herself was an amazing achievement, and she was the apple of the Kaiser's eye, now in the U.S. hands. And Gibbs boarded that ship and looked at this wreck. I mean, furniture had been smashed, there were troop bunks everywhere. And according to his brother, looked at his workmen and then used an extraordinary... gave an extraordinary speech laden with great curse words, and then ordered the men to start work on the blueprints to rebuild the ship. So he was a really charismatic individual who later said that he started off being very meek and very shy. Then he realized, I kind of have to be unpleasant to get what I want done.
Nice guys don't always finish first, I guess, huh? Talk a little bit about then what happened with the SS United States and probably many other ships like it. It enjoyed a period of popularity. It was busy for a long time. But what happened to sort of turn the tide, so to speak, no pun intended, so that suddenly she wasn't being used as much, that led to her ultimately being retired?
Well, propeller-driven planes were gaining popularity in the 1950s, but it was a bumpy ride. It was long. It was definitely didn't feel very safe. But it was in the late 50s, 1958, I believe, that the first jet entered service, and that changed everything. 6 hours versus 5 days, and all of a sudden, flying became very comfortable. It became relatively affordable, and by the early 60s, the big ships like the SS United States, the Queen Mary, the Queen Elizabeth, the Liberté, all began saw their numbers going down. And as one crew member told me, you first began noticing it in the winter when crossings were rough and very unpleasant. But then when it began hitting the summer months, mm-hmm. when traditionally people would go on these long vacations, that's when they began realizing this is a true paradigm shift. And William Francis Gibbs saw this trend even as early as the 1940s, but he even reasoned, well, people might want to take the ship one way and the plane another way, but he ended up being totally wrong.
Well, and you would think, Stephen, that just the journey itself, right, would be part of the whole experience, being able to travel on an ocean liner like that with all of its elegance and grandeur, that would be part of the experience, and not that it wouldn't be exciting to, you know, fly a jet as well, but you would think that that would have perhaps persuaded people to, as you said, maybe do travel on the ship one way, travel on the plane back, or vice versa, just to be part of that experience. But it sounds like the country was already beginning to move in a completely different direction.
Yeah, I think today there's a lot of nostalgia for that way of life. But I think in the late 50s or 60s, people were so excited about the modern, yeah. about what's next, and the space race was beginning. So I don't think there was that same sense of nostalgia that we have today. And there were some stalwarts, like the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. They travel on the SS United States exclusively, largely because the company gave them a very nice rate. And they refused to transfer over to jets. They continued to occupy their grand three-room suite and bring their pug dogs into the ship. But by and large, by the late 60s, it became clear that the SS United States had changed from being the fastest and most modern to kind of a quaint relic of what once was.
Days past. Let's go to the phones to University City, and we'll bring Jillian in on our conversation. Hi, Jillian.
Hi. I was curious what the future plans were for the ship, and also how much a ticket would have cost, and maybe with inflation, what that would have looked like today.
That's a very good question. First class began at around $500 or so in 1950s money. So that's probably around maybe $4,500 today. That's a lot of money. Cabin class, which was located in the stern of the ship, probably the equivalent of around $2,000 to $3,000. And maybe for tourist class, which was the least expensive, was probably the equivalent of about $1,000 per person one way. So it was not a cheap way to go across. First class, definitely, if you wanted one of the grand suites, you were paying about $1,100 per person one way, which was probably about $10,000 thereabouts in today's money. So it was not a cheap way to go. But the future plans for the ship, right now, the SS United States Conservancy is the owner of the SS United States, thanks to a very generous grant from Jerry Lenfest 2 years ago. Lenfest has given the Conservancy $5.8 million to purchase and then maintain the ship for 20 months. And basically, this move saved the ship from being scrapped. And the Conservancy's plans right now are to have the ship as a stationary waterfront attraction in a major American city. It's highly unlikely that she will be commercially viable as a passenger ship.
But perhaps a museum, that sort of thing, Stephen?
A museum, convention center, hotel. And there are a number of options the Conservancy is now exploring.
Yeah. Well, a casino was one of them. There was just something very recently in the paper that even that had been sort of thrown around as an option.
It was. Back in 2011, there was some really wonderful plans produced for the Foxwood sites for the SS United States as part of a casino, hotel, waterfront development on the Delaware River. And right now the Conservancy is open to any possibilities. New York is a possibility, Philadelphia, Miami. So I'm not directly involved with the redevelopment, but I think that it would be wonderful for people to be able to board the ship again.
Yeah.
And have her commercially viable.
Well, and we can't necessarily assume that it will remain in Philadelphia, correct?
No, that we can't assume that she'll remain in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Is that even logistically possible once the ship were refurbished? Is the location where it is now sufficient for it to even remain there?
The location now is probably not sufficient. She's right now docked there on an interim basis. Mm-hmm. But the Foxwood site was examined and is possible.
Okay. And certainly there's been talk about New York and some other places as well. So it'll be interesting to see where she might end up. As someone who has had a love for ships like this from a very young age. What is it like for you, just looking at the remains of this once great ship, and not that you were around in the days when it was in its heyday, but just to see it languishing there has got to be sad.
I think it's extremely tragic. I think this is, in many ways, the equivalent of Pennsylvania Station or the Brooklyn Bridge. This is a true landmark of American achievement. And I think what's happened now is, imagine what happened with Pennsylvania Station in the 1960s. Imagine someone had stepped in just before demolition began and stopped the clock. Yeah. And I think it's sad that something that took so much effort and so much dreaming has been let to languish like this. And I think one of the lessons from Gibbs's life is that this is someone who really pursued his passion, pursued his dreams against many, many obstacles. And I think the one he said that shaped him the most was his father's bankruptcy. He said, if it wasn't for the fact that my father had gone bankrupt, I wouldn't have achieved what I ended up doing. And I think his lesson, the lesson of his life is what can happen if you really follow your passion.
Yeah, absolutely. Did he live to see the demise of the ship?
Thankfully, no. He passed away in 1967, and the ship was taken out of service in November of 1969. But he was so in love with his creation that he would drop everything he was doing when she would come into port and drive over to the to Brooklyn and watch her go through the Verrazano Narrows, and then his car would follow her all the way to the pier on Manhattan, and he would jump on board and ask the captain how the ship performed. He would call the captain every day when she was at sea, and someone once asked him, "Mr. Gibbs, do you love that ship more than your wife?" And he said, "You're 1,000% correct." And apparently, his wife was very supportive of him. She didn't really mind that much.
But that was really his passion. And I think there is such a great lesson there about not only what a struggle can produce. You talked about his father's bankruptcy and that really being sort of the impetus for him, but also just his drivenness and the willingness to pursue something that would seem to most people an impossible ideal. And his willingness to stick with it over how many years, I guess, from the time that he first decided that this is what I want to do when I'm an adult to the time that the ship actually set sail was a lot of years.
Exactly. And he described himself as being a fighter. He said he had to. And he said often when someone comes up with a wonderful idea, people are very quick to tear him down. But he was also a very, he would often affect this very kind of curmudgeonly persona. But he was very loyal to his friends, and he also had a strange talent for being an MC at award ceremonies in New York. And he would often be called the pinch hit, and he had this sort of deadpan humor at one event at the Waldorf Astoria. It was the Edison Awards, I believe, and it was. I'll continue later on with that.
All right, we're going to give you a cliffhanger, and Stephen will tell us the rest of that story when we come back from the break. But we're talking about the SS United States, about its glory days, about its demise, and what the plans are for its future as well. You're listening to Radio Times.
The Violette DeMazia Foundation supports WHYY. Are you an art lover? The DeMazia Foundation teaches ways to appreciate works of art wherever you may encounter them. Classes and tours appropriate for anyone interested in seeing their world like an artist are forming at locations including the Barnes Foundation, Chester County Historical Society, and the Wallingford Community Arts Center. Registration is online at www.demazia.org.
On the next Fresh Air, why some people can't handle drinking coffee and why some babies are born with tails. Science writer Sam Keen tells the stories written by our genetic code. And we'll meet Jill Tarter. She's the scientist Jodie Foster's character in the film Contact was based on. She spent most of her career looking for signs of intelligent life in outer space. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
When faced with an injury or an illness, there's so much that can go through our minds, like how to make time to heal and how to get the support we need physically and emotionally. On the next Voices in the Family, when the body betrays, how we cope during and after the healing process. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We are talking about the glory days of the SS United States, the grand ocean liner, and how it was designed by a Philadelphian who, to a large degree, taught himself how to build ships, quite a remarkable personality in himself. The book is called A Man and His Ship. It's by Stephen Ujifusa, and it is the story of Gibbs and how he really brought his dream to pass in the form of the SS United States and what happened to it ultimately in terms of its retirement. And also we're talking about the plans for the future of that ship. We want to give our listeners an opportunity to call with questions about it. The number is 888-477-9499. Perhaps you've driven past it as you have traveled in and out of Philadelphia and wondered what was going on with that ship. But Stephen, when we left off, we were on a cliffhanger. You were telling us a story about Gibbs emceeing an event, and we never got to finish, so...
Well, Gibbs was at this very long, boring evening at the Waldorf Astoria, and he really didn't like cocktail parties. He thought they were boring. He would often sit in a corner and discuss music or art or literature. But at this evening, he decided, you know, I need to do something. So he got up and looked across the ballroom and just said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I've had many sad experiences. This by far is the worst."
No, he did not.
And he had that ability, that charisma, and to get an audience into the palm of his hand, and that's also how he led his firm through a lot of hard driving, but also humor.
Yeah, he sounds like almost a Bob Newhart type of personality, sort of a dry humor and very funny. A lot of things that we want to talk about, but first let's go to the phones to Cherry Hill and Jack. Welcome, Jack, to Radio Times.
Yes, I hello.
Hi there.
I was in Europe in 2001 on a elder hostel trip, and we visited an old no longer in use cruise terminal, and in that terminal there was a fantastic museum of all kinds of memorabilia of the SS United States. It kind of shocked me, but I think I found out that Bremerhaven was its main port when it was in Europe. Also, that there was a lot of work done on it there. Also, I heard that it was the ship was the first air-conditioned ocean liner. I don't know if that's true. And also, its propulsion system was apparently revolutionary. It was I assume it was electric, but I don't know. I don't completely understand it. I've looked at a lot of videos and read a lot of stuff about it. Anyway, this thing has fascinated me because when I saw it down in South Philadelphia, I took all kinds of pictures of it, and you know, because I had seen it in New York City in the 60s when it was still in operation. So, anyway, go ahead.
Well, you're in good company, Jack, being fascinated with that particular vessel. Stephen, what do you say?
Well, interesting you brought up the engines and that they were classified top secret because they were military engines. They were later used in the Forrestal aircraft carrier, and these engines could develop 250,000 horsepower. By comparison, the Queen Mary could only develop 160,000 horsepower. Wow. So these engines were top secret. You could not, as a passenger, say, "Hey, I want to tour the engine room." That was not allowed. Everything below the waterline was top secret. Only the Duke of Windsor was allowed a tour of the engine rooms. He was fascinated with ships. And the ship was the first fully air-conditioned ship of its type, which was quite revolutionary. It was hard to open the portholes because you'd let out the air conditioning.
Right, right.
And regarding Bremerhaven, during the winter months, she would call at Bremerhaven. Her summer route was New York to Le Havre, France, and then Le Havre, France to Southampton, England. But during the winter, she would call in Bremerhaven, and it was when she was in Bremerhaven that she would drop off many U.S. servicemen on their way to occupy Germany. And I've spoken to many people who traveled aboard the SS United States with their military fathers. And she would also pick up a number of German immigrants heading over in tourist class to England. And I've spoken to people who say, "Oh, my grandparents met on the SS United States immigrating over from Germany. And there was very little work in Germany after the war. It was devastated. So this ship was in many ways a lot of immigrants' first taste of America.
Interesting. Wow. Well, thanks to Jack for that call. We'll go next to Haddonfield and Patricia. Welcome, Patricia, to Radio Times.
Hello. Yes, I wanted to say that I am from Havana, Cuba, and when I was 14 years old, I sailed on the SS United States to Europe with my mother and aunt, and the trip was absolutely memorable. And when I saw the ship docked here in Philadelphia, I happened to be going to IKEA, and I said to my husband, I know that ship, I know that shape. Even before I saw the name on it, I knew it was the SS United States, and my heart started beating so fast. And even now when I retell the story, I feel such emotion because it was just a wonderful experience that I had when I was 14. And I just wanted to share that with you all. And also I wanted to say that a friend of mine, Irene Fernandez, with her parents, was on the maiden voyage when she was 9 years old. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, thank you, Patricia, for sharing that story with us.
It's amazing, those who I've spoken to who travel in the SS United States as kids just were just overwhelmed by it. A close family friend of ours traveled over with her father on the way to occupied Germany, and just a lot of kids described it as almost like being in a big floating playground. It's that sense of wonder that I think Gibbs had as a little kid. A lot of these kids shared, and it's wonderful to hear your sense of sadness at seeing the ship like this, because I've spoken to my good friend Joe Rota, who's a crew member, was a longtime crew member on the ship, and said he last saw the ship in 1969, just before she was taken out of service. And then he saw her again, I believe, in the late 90s for the first time. And he said like a cry came out of his throat of just sadness. He just said for the crew especially, the ship was their home, it was their place of work. It was like, you know, like their high school or college. It was everything to them.
Yeah. We had a question, too, from our Facebook page, Stephen, talking about the casino, which we mentioned just a few minutes ago as a possibility for this particular ship. And the question says, speaking as someone who has written about the symbolism of the ship, would you be concerned from a symbolic point of view if it was turned into a casino? What are your thoughts about that possibility?
I mean, right now, my position regarding that is, as a writer, is I think it'd be wonderful if she could be returned to sea again. But I think at the end of the day, what will make her commercially viable? Because the alternative is she will get sent to the scrap heap.
Yeah.
So it's a tough question, because if there's no firm real estate deal by November of this year, and also, the Conservancy is looking for public grassroots support. That ship is going to get sent to a Gulf Coast beach and get sliced up for scrap. And if anyone's seen pictures of ships getting scrapped in India, it's not a pretty sight.
Yeah. Let's go to Germantown and Jane. Welcome, Jane, to Radio Times. Jane, are you with us? No, I think we may have.
No, I'm with you.
Oh, there you go. Hi, Jane. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I sailed on the United States when I was a little girl. I was about 12 years old. My family was returning from Germany. My father was a colonel in the Army. So we were up on the sun deck. And my most vivid memory is that we played ping pong all the way across, because it was so smooth. The action of the ship, it didn't go from side to side at all. It surged forward all the time.
Well, thank you, Jane, for sharing that with us. It's so interesting to me, Stephen, how many of our listeners have some personal experience with the ship.
No, it is interesting, and I think it says something of what the ship meant back then. And regarding the ship being very stable, she never was outfitted with stabilizers, and her hull design was such that she could cut through the ocean. Some of the older ships, like the Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mary, when they hit rough seas, would drop sickeningly forward. But that's not to say that the SS United States didn't roll in bad weather. During hurricanes, she would roll. And one story I've heard early in the ship's career was that she was struck by a freak wave. This is in the middle of gala dinner night, and a steward who was in the first class dining room saw everyone go flying to one end. No one got hurt, but they later installed seat belts under the chairs.
Just in case. Yeah,
but my grandmother said that she played bridge all the way across, and she said it was a very pleasant way to cross.
Wow. We'll go next to Ocean View and Lou. Welcome, Lou, to Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, this is Lou Albrecht. Why, one time I visited the Queen Mary out at Long Beach, and I asked a question about fuel consumption, and they said that it would get about 12 feet per gallon. I was kind of shocked. How about the fuel consumption on the United States?
The United States consumed about 600 to 700 tons of fuel a day, which is pretty fuel hungry considering today's cruise ships would only, I believe, consume about 200 or 100 tons per fuel a day. And so that's a lot of fuel. That's a lot of oil. And William Francis Gibbs would not discuss the ship's fuel consumption over the air when he would call into the ship's captain because he was afraid that someone was listening in. That, too, was classified.
He covered all the bases, so he did. Let's talk about your creative process with this, Stephen. What was it that prompted you to write this book, and what was that experience like for you, compiling all of this information?
Well, for me, I've been interested in ships and the sea since I was a little kid, and my grandmother told me the story of the Titanic, and I became interested in ocean liners and all types of ships. I would build models as a kid. And I thought about becoming an architect or an engineer, but my math skills weren't so great. I was always, you know, my parents supported my interests, and they got me books, which I later ended up using in the research. But I moved to Philadelphia in 2003 for graduate school, and around 2007, I was approached by Plan Philly, a website run by the University of Pennsylvania, to write about something on the waterfront. And I said, well, how about the SS United States? And Matt Golis, the editor of Plan Philly, said, well, we've been meaning to have someone write about that for a long time. And I lived in the Rittenhouse Square area, and I began doing some research. And first I did some stuff about the ship, but then I began looking more into William Francis Gibbs and found out that he grew up in Rittenhouse Square. And the first portion of the book I wrote was, what was it like living in Rittenhouse Square around 1900, mm-hmm. when it was so grand and so magnificent? What was this childhood like for William Francis Gibbs, this sort of poor little rich boy who was antisocial, who was locked up in his father's mansion? And that was the first part I wrote and sort of expanded outward from that.
Oh, so interesting. And how long did it take for you to compile all of this? I mean, this is a very well-researched book.
Thank you. It took about 4.5 years and involved a lot of interviews with crew members and people had traveled on the ship. It involved a lot of visits to the Mariner's Museum in Newport News, Virginia. And thankfully, when I showed up there, when I was working on my book proposal, it turned out that Frederick Gibbs, William Francis Gibbs' brother, had preserved all the records, all the correspondence related to the construction of the SS United States. And it was almost thrown out in the 70s. And Frederick Gibbs was just terrified of his brother's legacy being lost. Frederick Gibbs is a very quiet, unassuming man who was just, he was there for his brother the whole time. And when he found out that Gibbs and Cox was going to throw away all this stuff, he grabbed it. He grabbed everything he could and gave it to the Mariners Museum.
Unbelievable. Stephen, I said before the show that I think this book was meant for you to write, just with all the connections that you have. I mean, your grandparents sailed on it. You had such an interest in ships from the time that you were very young. And even when you see something like this happen, that, you know, seeing those records being preserved that were nearly thrown out, that were critical, I'm sure, to, you know, helping you as you put the book together.
Yeah, and I think that for me, the story of Gibbs was a story that really just had to be told, especially in times like these. He's forgotten in many ways, and I think he really deserves a place alongside the great builders of American history, whether it's John Augustus Roebling, the Brooklyn Bridge, or Frank Lloyd Wright. I think he and Wright shared a lot of similarities. Wright only took a few semesters of architecture at the University of Wisconsin, then decided to work under Louis Sullivan and learn by doing, and Gibbs had a very similar
background. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to preserve the legacies of these kinds of ships?
For me, it's a legacy of American achievement. I think that's something that's kind of lost today. And it really was a symbol of when America could build things. It's a symbol of a reminder of what we can do when we dream big. And William Francis Gibbs's dream ended up touching the lives of so many people, whether they're crew members or passengers. He was a very shy, formal man, but he used this ship to sort of reach out to people. That's how he connected with people in many ways.
Well, we have less than a minute, Stephen, but your book has just come out. When you think about what you want readers to get out of your book, you know, if you get nothing else out of the book, this is what I want you to get. What's the one thing you want readers to take away from this?
Basically, the story of an American who thought big, dreamed big, and pursued his dream and saw it come to fruition, and what it takes to create something truly beautiful and lasting.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see what the future of the SS United States is. That's a story that we'll continue to follow for some time, no doubt. But I just want to thank you for writing this book, first of all, and preserving this history for us, and giving us such an insightful background into the designer of the ship and what a remarkable personality he was. We appreciate the research that you've done and the fact that you've been able to preserve the story, and hopefully there will be greater efforts to preserve the ship as well.
Thank you so much, Tracy.
So the book is called A Man and His Ship. The author is Stephen Ujifusa. It just came out. It's the history of the SS United States and its designer, Gibbs. And there's so much interesting information, not only about the ship, but about the history of our country, where we were at that time. And there is much to look forward to as we wait to see what's going to happen to that ship in her latter days. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. Our engineer is Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Dennis Devine, Patty Leswing and McMahon, and Debbie Builder. And you have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.